Council, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jonathan Hallen. I represent the appellant Adam Hardy in this matter. I'd like to begin by speaking in order of the issues presented in Mr. Hardy's brief and begin with the challenge to the denial of Mr. Hardy's motion to suppress. Mr. Hardy found himself in the eyes of law enforcement after law enforcement conducted three controlled buys in late July and early August of 2018. And acting on this information, law enforcement obtained a search warrant for a residence that they believed that was used by Mr. Hardy. In planning to execute on that search warrant, law enforcement developed an operations plan whereby the concern was to prevent the destruction of evidence. And so the plan was to make contact and execute on the warrant once Mr. Hardy was seen leaving the residence or known to be outside of the residence. Law enforcement waited for over 2 hours once they executed on this search warrant. And after he had left the residence in a vehicle, then they did in fact pull him over and simultaneously executed the search warrant. According to law enforcement, they fully intended to arrest Mr. Hardy for the controlled buys and believed that they had reasonable suspicion to justify or probable cause to justify his warrantless arrest based upon those three controlled buys. And that was to take place contemporaneous with the execution of the search warrant. After waiting for over 43 minutes, the law enforcement made the decision to execute upon the arrest of Mr. Hardy and then carried out a inventory search according to developed policy of the regional law enforcement. Now, this case presents the opportunity to further define what constitutes the requisite something else that transforms a legitimate inventory search, a search that's designed to account for property while insuring against claims of loss and stolen property, into an unlawful rummage for evidence in violation of the Fourth Amendment. In this court's decision in Gray, the court noted that there must be something else, something to suggest that police raised the inventory search banner in an after-effect attempt to justify a simple investigatory search for incriminating evidence.
May I ask, you're not arguing, or are you, that the officers, you know, in some way violated the policy relating to inventory searches of vehicles of people who are arrested, are you?
No, and that policy is in the record.
That's what I thought. But then, isn't your argument really just the whole operation? You know, the arrest, so that they could do the inventory search of the car. That it was all pretextual. That they were just doing it that way because they wanted to be able to do the search.
Yes, I mean, essentially, the argument is that the manner in which the search warrant was executed and their operations plan was developed was such that it essentially broadened the scope of the search warrant to include this vehicle. The way they went about executing on the search warrant, because they waited until Mr. Hardy was in a vehicle, they waited to stop him until he was operating this vehicle, and they created this need to conduct this inventory search.
And how is that argument consistent with Wren, right, which says that, you know, the fact that, you know, that they could have done it some other way, but if they're doing it in a lawful way, the fact that they have, you know, that it's all pretextual and they have the motive of being able to do a search, like Wren says, they can do that, doesn't it?
Well, you can have dual motives, certainly, and this court has said that. The concern here is that, you know, the typical run-of-the-mill cases, Florida versus Wells or Gray, it's the defendant that creates the need for the inventory search. in Florida versus Wells, the defendant was driving while intoxicated, and subsequently law enforcement arrested the defendant for suspicion of DUI. And in Garay, the defendant fled, and it was a high-speed chase, and then the defendant crashed the vehicle into a ditch, and so law enforcement had no choice but to tow the vehicle. And prior to towing, they had to conduct this inventory search. In this case, we have law enforcement that created the need for the inventory search. And so if you look to, again, Garay, the court, this court has said there must be something else. And this case presents the opportunity for this court to define what is that something else.
So I mean, the government suggests that the officers arrested him in the car because they wanted to prevent interference with the search of the house. So why isn't that a sufficient motivation?
Well, I think the operations plan wasn't necessarily to arrest Mr. States, that it wasn't carried out to with the purpose of arresting him while he was in a vehicle. The purpose was to wait until Mr. Forty was outside of the residence to prevent destruction of evidence, and whether he was outside in the curtilage or whether he was in a vehicle, I think the intent was just to wait until he was outside and they can make contact with him and then execute on the search warrant.
Isn't that a legitimate basis for waiting to arrest him? And if he's in the car, which he didn't own, then they followed their inventory procedures. So the government argues, well, that certainly was a sufficient motivation. Why do you say that's not sufficient?
Well, in a case such as this, where law enforcement has control of the situation and creates the need, I believe that the minimal requirement that law enforcement obtain issuance of a search warrant before searching a vehicle is a nominal minimal requirement to ensure that law enforcement doesn't necessarily broaden the scope of a lawful search warrant for a residence into including and enveloping a vehicle. And that's what happened here. And so I submit that in a case like this, where you have law enforcement that is controlled situation, can dictate how the search warrant is executed, can dictate what necessarily gets wrapped up into that search warrant, that they should be required to, they can still impound the vehicle, but they just need, in this instance, they should be required to go to a neutral and detached magistrate and ask for the...
You're arguing what the law should be, perhaps. You're arguing that they should be required to have gotten two search warrants, but the law doesn't require that. And isn't it correct that your client was asked at the vehicle whether he had a preferred tow company? Isn't that part of the record?
That is correct, but that still doesn't... That would not have avoided the need to conduct an inventory search. If you look to the law enforcement's policy, unless there's somebody at the scene that is a registered and sober driver, they're gonna impound that vehicle and conduct an inventory search.
Well, but your client said he didn't have a preferred tow company. He said he didn't, it wasn't his vehicle, correct?
That's correct. But whether he had a preferred tow company or not, that isn't dispositive of whether law enforcement was going to conduct an inventory search.
Well, but isn't the standard that it essentially solely has to be pretextual? Let's talk about what the law is. I mean, you talked about dual motives, so aren't I correct?
Well, the law in this circuit is that if you have, if there's something else that is motivating law enforcement, and that's something else other than the need to protect and preserve the contents of the vehicle and insure against claims, then that transforms the search into an unlawful search. And that this court has never defined, short of law enforcement's admission, yeah, we were on a rummage for evidence and we weren't motivated by inventorying the contents, such as in Johnson. So short of that admission, this court has never defined what that something else is. And I think that this case defines or presents an opportunity for this court to further define what that something else is. I'd like to move on to the next issue because I'm running out of time. In this case, There's two defense witnesses that were subpoenaed at trial and allowed to exercise a blanket assertion of Fifth Amendment privilege and prevent or avoid testifying or appearing in front of the jury whatsoever. And this court in Pierce in 1977 said the blanket assertion is unacceptable. And a few years later in Troy, the court carved out what has been since recognized in Moore as a very narrow exception where the court has very specialized knowledge of circumstances that can give rise to the need for the witness to assert a Fifth Amendment privilege. And if you look to this, the Choi case, you had testimony that had been presented in trial prior to the witness taking the stand and asserting the Fifth Amendment privilege. And that testimony directly implicated the witness in the same crime that the defendant was on trial for. And there was testimony in that case that that witness was also under investigation for the same exact conduct. And so the court in that case said, well, the trial judge had special knowledge as for the basis for the witness's blanket assertion of Fifth Amendment privilege. If you look further to the Moore decision, which I think is on par with this case, the court noted that the blanket assertion was incorrectly invoked. And in footnote 3, this court highlighted the fact that there was a colloquy between defense counsel and the U.S. attorney and the court as to exactly what the basis of the criminal liability would be. And that's exactly what took place here.
I wasn't sure what questions. The district court thought that anything that the two witnesses would testify to that was consistent with Horty's theory of the case would implicate them in possible illegal activity. It wasn't clear to me what questions would be asked of these witnesses that wouldn't implicate them other than their name and those sorts of things. What sorts of questions would not have implicated them in criminal activity of their own, given, I guess, one of them was on probation and this law about frequenting was she was cited, another one was cited for frequenting?
Well, you're correct. I mean, but that goes to the fact that the record is really unclear as to what was the criminal liability, and we have this dialogue occurring in the court as to between the court and the U.S. attorney and the witness's attorney and the defense counsel as to what exactly this criminal liability is giving rise to this assertion of blanket or the Fifth Amendment privilege. And the court was questioning it. The court didn't have that specialized knowledge that the court in Choi did. And that's why I think that the assertion or allowing the witnesses in this case to assert the blanket assertion was improper because the court didn't even know what the basis was. We have the questions whether the frequenting even applied, and it's a one-year statute of limitations for a misdemeanor, which one year had already.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just following up on Judge Ikuda, even admitting that you lived in the residence or frequented it potentially creates liability as to knowledge, conspiracy, participation, a whole host of unpredictable things. So, even your name, even your identity could create potential criminal liability if your identity is associated with a room where maybe your personal items are found and there are distribution materials like scales and things like that. So I'm just having a difficult time understanding what would not be incriminating, irrespective of whether some potential frequenting statute may or may not have been violated.
Well, and to follow up to your statement, Judge Pregerson, is unlike in Choi, in this case, what we have is just a generalized claim that there is potential criminal liability. In Choi, there was specific testimony that had been elicited during trial defining the involvement of this witness and the very real criminal liability that that witness faced if he were to testify and implicate himself in that case. In this instance, there is nothing in the record at trial or in the motion to suppress that gives a specific basis for the nature of the liability that either witness faced if they were to testify. And the other thing I would like to note is that at the time of the search warrant, both of these witnesses made statements to law enforcement. And so, I think at a minimum, my client should have been allowed to question them about what those statements were on the stand in front of the jury. And Mr. Horty was not allowed to do that. And the other
your time is expired, but we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bryce Ellsworth, and I represent the United States in this appeal. Your Honor, as to the first issue in regards to the inventory search, there's no evidence in the record to support the defendant's position that the stop was pretextual. In fact, to the contrary, officers testified that when they were staging for the search, they staged away in a church parking lot because of the remoteness of the house and the inability to surveil it much closer, and that they never saw Mr. Horty exit the home. It wasn't until they saw him driving a red Camaro on a dirt road behind the house that they were then able to follow that vehicle and pull him over. They didn't know what car he would drive at the time. That wasn't the only vehicle available to him. And even Mr. Horty testified to the fact that around that house was multiple vehicles, boats, and specifically a truck that was titled to him. And so at no point were officers staging this so that they could search this red Camaro. Instead, they pull him over per the operations plan, and they immediately arrest him, notify him of the search warrant, that there is a drug investigation, and they have him stand by away from the home while they execute the search warrant. After locating a plethora of criminal items in the home, guns, drug paraphernalia, and drugs, they notify him of his arrest and, pursuant to the policy, search the vehicle. And they follow the policy to the T. They ask him who he'd like to tow the vehicle. They pull out an inventory form. They inventory everything. Even after they find this cooler with thousands of dollars and a large quantity of meth, the officer doesn't stop there. He continues to inventory the vehicle as required by law. And so in no way is this a pretext to search the vehicle and avoid a warrant requirement. Instead, the officers properly searched the vehicle according to the inventory search exception and ultimately located the drugs in plain view. As to the Fifth Amendment issue, I think the court's made it clear that anything these witnesses said would implicate them in a possible crime. And the district court also understood that. At Excerpt of Record 148, the court says both women could refuse to answer essentially all questions. And it was because placing them in that house where there's multiple firearms, multiple items of drug paraphernalia, items that associated them to living there and or staying there, and tying them to Mr. Horty would potentially lead to them being investigated and charged with either conspiracy or possession and furtherance. There's a plethora of charges that would meet that criteria. And here, the court very thoughtfully went through this process where all the questions were presented to the witnesses and their attorneys, and then it was addressed on the record to ensure that they understood what their right was and that the law was followed in regards to balancing the defendant's Sixth Amendment right with these witnesses' Fifth Amendment right. And so the government asked that the court affirm on this issue too. The final issue addressed in the appeal is the enhancement instruction. And again, I think the district court very thoughtfully went through this and put on the record what was necessary for the enhancement instruction under United States Sentencing Guidelines Section 3C1.1 to apply. The court identified that the defendant had given false testimony, that it was on a material matter, and with willful intent.
What was the What was the specific testimony that the district court identified as false?
So the district court summarized it in a statement, and the statement that the district court said was that the testimony offered by the defendant was material to his sales and possession with intent to distribute meth and his knowing possession of firearms as a previously convicted felon. That testimony was blatantly false. And so essentially he identifies the fact that, and as you review the defendant's testimony, it comes out very clear. The defendant agrees to all the facts.
Aside from the defendant's testimony, we're looking at the record that the district court made. Isn't that what we need so we can evaluate the applicability of the obstruction enhancement?
Yes.
I'm going back to the record. I'm talking about what the court said in terms of meeting a reviewability requirement. That's what we're looking at, right?
Yes, and that's the court addresses exactly what he lied about, and it was the information.
Exactly, but it was just a general statement of guilt.
Well, it was specific to the elements of the crime that the government proved during the course of the trial.
Are you aware of any case holding that the district court has an obligation to specify the statements that are false and explain why they're false? I know we have a case, United States v. Acuna, which is fairly old, 1993, which says that a district court is not required to enumerate specifically which portions of a defendant's testimony are false to justify an enhancement for obstruction of justice. That's from 1993, though. Are you aware of any case that's overruled that holding?
I'm not aware of any other case, Your Honor, that would overrule that holding. There needs to be specificity, and those three issues need to be addressed, and I think the court does that here by identifying the subject matter in which he testified falsely to, which was essentially the elements of the crime.
So we say that for perjury to be deemed obstruction, the district court must find that the defendant gave false testimony on a material matter with willful intent. And so your position is that the district court made a finding on each of those issues. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. When you read the court statement, it addresses each of those issues in that it identifies that the statements were false. The court talks about it being blatant and that he lied in an effort to sway the jury to his side in regards to his willfulness. And then the false testimony is identified as his testimony in regards to the sale and possession of methamphetamine and the firearms.
Thank you.
But doesn't the district court also say that the court also says, and by the way, the jury agreed he was convicted. And then we get into the area of sort of circular logic, where how do you review knowing how much reliance the district court may have placed on the post hoc fact that a jury made a finding of guilt, the equivalent of he must have lied because the jury convicted him. And it just highlights the problem. If we were dealing with a bench trial and we were dealing with a significant enhancement, we would want to have a reviewable basis for that. So I don't understand how the logic here differs from that requirement. What is there to review?
Your Honor, I think when you take the district court's position as he was he sat through the trial, he heard the suppression motion, he was in a position that he understood all the evidence in multiple hearings, and he made this finding independent of what the jury found, and then his secondary statement was, and the jury also agreed. So I understand that statement, if that was all the court was relying on, would be concerning, but that's not the case. He independently made a finding that the defendant gave false testimony on a material matter with willful intent.
And what did he say that was reviewable by us?
I apologize, I couldn't hear that question.
What was said that would give us some ability to review the logic?
What was said by the court or by the...
By the court.
That is the statement that the district court made on excerpt of record page 32 and 33.
Right. So what's reviewable about that? How can we possibly take a look at the testimony and evidence and review that for accuracy.
Well, Your Honor, when you see that the court identifies what the specific lie was to, which was the material elements of sale and possession, and then you look at the defendant's testimony, which isn't very long, and you can find...
Out going outside the record, we could always do that, but the you know, here's the, maybe it's just being a district court judge here and I'm just stepping up. I think it's just important that I make a reviewable record whenever I do something that affects the substantial rights of a defendant. And I'm just very aware of that through, you know, over 1,000 federal sentencings. So I'm just, you know, I'm concerned that we're on a slope where we're not requiring that sort of rigor when it comes to making statements that are appropriately reviewable. And it also concerns me that, you know, you might be in a situation where a defendant is counseled by his attorney, you know, by the way, one of the increased risks of you testifying is that a court may adjudge without giving any reasons that you committed obstruction. And that could result in an enhanced sentence. Therefore, you know, I've got to warn you that that testifying itself creates this risk if the court decides without any reviewable reason that you weren't telling the truth. And I know I'm drifting into policy a little bit, but perhaps you could address that.
Your Honor, I think there is a very reviewable record here that supports what the court said. When you look at the defendant's testimony, I mean, you start out with just the house alone, and this he testified at Excerpt of Records 169 through 187, but when you start out with the house alone, he admits that he used that back room, that him and his girlfriend had been moving into that house. He admits that most of the items in the room are his, including clothing, the safe, the bed, the gun case. But then he denies all the elements that would be criminal, essentially. He says, I never saw any of the pipes, the three pipes that are in the room. I didn't see the Ziploc baggies, the baggies that were in the safe that he said he owned.
Just to reiterate, we shouldn't focus on the reasons given by the district court. We should focus on the record.
And I think the record clearly shows.
Because that's what you're doing.
Are we reviewing for abuse of discretion, or what's the standard of review for this finding?
This is for clear error.
For clear error.
And maybe this is a question for your friend, but rather than for you, but when I looking at clearly the defendant objected to the application of the enhancement, but do you understand there to have been an objection on the ground that the false statement was insufficiently identified or that the district court had not been specific enough?
No, Your Honor, it was just an objection in general, and there wasn't much argument by defense counsel in regards to it.
So do you think that the claim that I don't know which statement you found to be false, or you had to identify a specific statement. Is that a claim that's preserved for our review?
Your Honor, it hasn't been one raised by defense counsel, and I would note that just prior to the court...
So would we be reviewing for plain error, just to follow up on Judge Miller's question, with respect to... So in the briefing, there was an objection to the lack of specificity, but he didn't raise that at trial. So is our review for plain error?
I hadn't considered this until the court's addressing it now, but based off of what you're saying, I believe so. At that point, they didn't object to that specific, they didn't object to this at the sentencing level. And so, yes, I do believe that it could be plain error too.
But the plain error, just to be clear, you would review the court's decision, its logic, on the basis of plain error, what it articulated. You do not review whether the court articulated the appropriate elements to begin with in a way that comports with just due process requirements for plain air. Those are different things in my mind.
The government's position is, regardless, the court made it very clear what he was finding, the fact that the defendant gave false testimony on a material matter with willful intent. And though the statement is fairly brief, there was an argument against it. With that, Your Honor, I do believe that the court, on all three of these issues, took extensive time to go through them thoroughly and ensure that the defendant's rights were protected as to each and that the law was followed. And I'd ask that the court uphold the rulings below. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your argument. And we'll give, I guess it's Mr. Holland, a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you. And very briefly, I'd like to return to the assertion of Fifth Amendment privilege issue, because I think in this case it's very important to note that how it impacted Mr. Horty's ability to present a defense or his theory of a defense. In this case, we had the CI who was subpoenaed by Mr. Horty. The CI stopped cooperating with law enforcement and did not appear at trial. We have two defense witnesses who were subpoenaed and allowed to and excused on nothing more than their blanket assertion of their Fifth Amendment privilege. And so I think what we have here is a complete denial of his ability to present a theory of a defense case. And I'd like to move on to the final issue because I'm running out of time here. I think this issue is the manner in which the court applied the enhancement not only denies his ability to conduct any review of the enhancement, but it also is important because that there was no notice given to Mr. Horty that this issue was at play. I see that I'm out of time. Can I finish my comment?
Sure.
No notice was given to Mr. Horty in the PSR that the enhancement was even at play. So he shows up to sentencing hearing, and the issue is first raised sua sponte by the district court. And the manner in which it was raised was very generalized. There was no specific findings made. And so how was Mr. Horty to respond to the court's intention to imply the perjury enhancement?
But was there any objection on the lack of notice? I mean, a trial counsel didn't say, you know, "I'm sorry, Your Honor, I need more time to respond to this," or anything like that, did he?
Well, Your Honor, I think there is a general objection in the record in the transcript, but again, it goes back to the fact that there was no notice given. Generally, what you have here is a PSR will be provided, you know, weeks in advance of sentencing. It'll make note that the perjury enhancement or the obstruction enhancement is at play, and the parties have a chance to brief the issue and bring witnesses to the sentencing hearing. That didn't happen here. So Mr. Horty shows up and he's on his heels. Oh, this two-level enhancement is at play here. This is a very important issue. The other issue goes back to Judge Pregerson's comments. You know, if the fact that the jury convicted Mr. Horty is enough to give rise to the falsity element, what we would have here is in every single instance where a defendant testifies and is convicted by a jury trial, the perjury enhancement could be at play. And that would be an extreme hindrance to a defendant's, ability to testify or willingness to testify at trial, because if you do testify and you're convicted, you're going to get two-level enhancement. Okay. So you better not do it.
I think we have your argument. Thank you. The case of United States versus Adam Christopher Horty is submitted, and we'll next hear argument in the case of United States versus Eric Bruce Fowler.